From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The invasion of Iraq was a textbook triumph of third-generation warfare. Overwhelming air power levels the enemy's defenses. Battalions of tanks and troop carriers roll through what's left to take control. It was fast and decisive, but only for a moment. Before the dust had even settled, another war began, a different kind of war, more complex and much harder to win. The U.S. is still fighting that war. Tonight on Point, fourth-generation warfare and the insurgency challenge after the elections in Iraq. But first tonight, we turn to Rome, where Pope John Paul II was rushed to a hospital tonight with breathing problems and the flu. Romans reportedly gathered outside the hospital concerned about the pontiff's health. The 84-year-old pope suffers from Parkinson's disease and chronic hip and knee problems. Earlier today, the Vatican canceled his appointments for the next few days. John Allen covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. I asked him for the latest tonight on the pope's health.
Well, what we know is that shortly before 11 p.m. Rome time, the Pope was taken to Gemelli Hospital, which is probably the most prestigious hospital here in Rome, and it's one he has visited on a number of occasions in the past for various health issues. The Vatican has indicated in a statement just moments ago that this was due to a respiratory problem involving his larynx, which is not uncommon for people suffering from Parkinson's disease, especially elderly sufferers. And they are indicating, officially at least, that they do not regard this as anything alarming. So the situation is that he is under medical care at Gemelli Hospital, taken there unexpectedly late this evening. And at the moment, that's about all we know. We're, of course, going to have to see how this develops.
And yet, at his age, 84, and with the infirmities he's been wrestling with, people paying close attention, we're reading about Italians gathering in the streets outside the hospital. They earlier described this as a breathing crisis. Have they said that he's in stable condition?
Well, that's the indication at the moment. I think probably two points ought to be made. One is that when you have someone at 84 years of age who is suffering from Parkinson's disease and who has the obvious breathing problems that anyone who has seen the Pope in recent months has noted, obviously this is a cause for concern. And it is very rare for the Pope to be taken unexpectedly late at night to the hospital. That indicates that there was something serious enough here that that it needed immediate attention. On the other hand, this is a man, John Paul II, who has a remarkable physical resilience and, of course, has outlived many previous health crises. So one should never underestimate his capacity to weather the storm. That's why I say that I think we need to see how this develops over the next few hours.
How has the Pope's health appeared in recent weeks and months? What has his schedule been? Has he been receiving visitors, traveling?
Yes. I mean, as a matter of fact, I was just in an audience with the Pope a few days ago when he received a delegation of some almost 100 rabbis from the United States and Israel. He's been keeping up his public schedule, although, of course, his schedule cleared this week because of flu. I think actually one of the striking things is that if you compare the Pope in the last, say, 3 months to the way he appeared, say, last October when he celebrated his 25th anniversary as Pope, really the story has been what has seemed a remarkable resurgence. I mean, his voice was clearer, his complexion was better, he seemed much less frail, much more in control of his movements. So, you know, that has been sort of the dominant Pope health story in the last few weeks, which is why this has been in so many ways such a bolt from the blue.
John Allen, as you say, Pope John Paul has been a very durable man. His health has been remarkably sturdy, yet he's 84. He's suffering from Parkinson's, as you say. When his health gets in real trouble, how will the world know? Is there a protocol that the Vatican will follow when and if that comes?
Well, traditionally, the protocol was that when the Pope was on his deathbed, black bunting would be hung, and then when he actually died, Vatican radio would begin playing funeral music, and that was sort of the first indication that it had happened. But, you know, we're in a different age in which the gap between when something happens and when it becomes known is just much, much tighter. You know, I suspect what will happen this time, as indeed what happened this evening, word will be available very, very quickly. And I think the protocol probably, to be honest, is that even inside the Vatican itself, they will probably be hearing it from the wire agencies before they hear it through official channels. And I'm sure that's how all of us will learn about it as well.
There's been a flu sweeping through Italy since December. The Pope is canceling his audiences this week for the first time since September 2003. What is his forward schedule? Does he have travel upcoming scheduled?
Well, the only trip that has been sort of semi-confirmed is a gathering of Catholic youth in Cologne, Germany. The German bishops have confirmed that the Pope is coming, although the Vatican, officially speaking, has not confirmed that. But it's widely expected that, assuming his health permits it, he'll be there. But, you know, just earlier this morning, the Vatican was working on trying to arrange a time for a meeting between the new American Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, and the Pope during her visit to Italy early next week. So there certainly was no expectation in the Vatican earlier today that whatever the Pope's health problems are, that he wouldn't pull through them in relatively short order. And that continues to be the tone. I was talking to a couple of very senior Vatican officials just moments ago, and they were at least projecting a tremendous calm, taking the view that this was a not particularly alarming development, and certainly had the expectation that the Pope would pull through it. And I think that probably is based, at least in part, on the experience of so many previous health crises when people's alarms went off, and in fact, the Pope came through in good form. So, you know, the expectation as of this hour in Rome is that that will be the storyline again this time.
Pope John Paul II hospitalized tonight, but apparently in stable condition. John Allen in Rome, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
John Allen covers the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. He spoke with me from Rome. Once upon a time, wars were fought with huge mechanized divisions and massed swarms of soldiers. The key to victory was superior firepower on land, air, and sea. The Pentagon and the Soviet Kremlin came of age in that world and built superpowers on the model. Then came the modern guerrilla fighter, using any weapon at hand and a keen ability to measure the will of the enemy. Tanks and cannon were replaced by weapons like patience, invisibility, terror, and lately, the Internet. War changed. Whether it's Baghdad or Bosnia, heavy firepower can still take ground. But fighting an insurgency means having to keep it, sometimes for decades. And that is a battle, says our guest tonight, that the U.S. may not have truly begun to fight. Tonight on Point, fourth-generation warfare and the insurgency challenge after the election in Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you see the insurgency in Iraq being waged at many levels, political, social, economic, and military? Soldiers, what have you seen firsthand? Are U.S. troops being trained and deployed to win this kind of fourth-generation war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Thomas Hammes, Marine Corps Colonel, Senior Military Fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University, and author of The Sling and the Stone on War in the 21st Century. From January to March last year, he managed bases, facilities, and logistics supporting the training operations of Iraqi armed forces in Iraq. Colonel Thomas Hammes, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
You describe the United States as not necessarily really at grips with the war that's going on in Iraq, a fourth-generation war, you call it. What do you mean by that, Colonel?
Well, essentially, we were trying to figure out a model that would allow us to see where warfare is going. And we looked at modern warfare, and warfare evolves in accordance with the political, economic, social, and technical evolution of the society. And for the fourth-generation model, we kept it pretty simple. First generation uses massed manpower. Think Napoleonic War, where the people are in very, very close, banging away each other at point-blank range. You win by massing more men on the battlefield than the other guy can. Second generation is about massed firepower. Now think World War I, where the battlefields are empty, but there's a massive amount of firepower. Third generation is generally considered to be maneuver warfare, which most people think of as mechanized warfare, but they're not quite the same. But the general view of it is the German panzers striking across France, Poland, Russia, and those were the three modern generations. We started, well, what would the fourth be? And we think, or at least I think, and that's the thesis of my book, is that fourth generation is insurgency using the new tools that have been developed in terms of networks. And the idea is they'll use all available networks to, rather than try to defeat you militarily, they'll break your political will. And the focus of insurgency is breaking the political will of the opposition using political, social, economic, and military means.
And you say it has worked against the United States, and not just once, but three times.
Yes. In Vietnam, we were clearly beaten by a fourth-generation enemy. I would also say that in Somalia, although we didn't have a great deal invested there, we were driven out by fourth-generation techniques, and also in Lebanon when we were driven out by the Beirut bombing.
With all that learning behind the Pentagon, is the Pentagon fighting a fourth-generation war itself in Iraq, or still trying to fight the old-style war?
I think the services and the people in Iraq get it. It's pretty clear that Ambassador Negroponte and General Casey do. I don't see a lot of indication that the Pentagon itself has figured this out. The Pentagon, since 1990, has run a series of different names for the same thing. They called it Revolution in Military Affairs. Mm-hmm. Then they called it Joint Vision 2010, Joint Vision 2020, Network-Centric Warfare. Now it's Transformation. And they all say essentially the same thing, that warfare is going to be high technology, short wars, dominated by these networked, light, high technology forces.
And is that working in Iraq?
No. That's the problem, is the enemy gets a vote in any war. And frankly, the enemies looked at this, the enemies of the United States, and said, we cannot fight them in this form. If you look at what happens if you fight the United States that way, you get killed pretty quickly. If you look at Desert Storm, if you look at Operation Iraqi Freedom, if you try to fight us conventionally, you get beaten easily.
Can the United States lose in Iraq?
Oh, yes. I mean, any war you can lose, if your political will goes away, your determination to stay in the game and win, then you can lose.
And that is the whole point of fourth-generation warfare, you say, to sap that will.
Yes, and in fact, it has been the dominant form of war now for about 50 years.
Thomas Hammes, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about fourth-generation warfare. My guest is Thomas Hammes, author of The Sling and the Stone. We're looking at the insurgency challenge after the election in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Washington helped Iraq pull off the vote, but can it win this war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about fourth-generation warfare and the insurgency challenge after the election in Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? America has retreated from three guerrilla wars, Vietnam, Lebanon, and Somalia. Will Iraq be different, and how? And soldiers, what have you seen firsthand in Iraq? Who's calling the tune there? Who's winning? Are U.S. forces being trained and deployed to win this kind of war? And can it be done? Can the Iraqi military one day do it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Marine Colonel Thomas Hammes. He's author of The Sling and the Stone on War in the 21st Century. Thomas Hammes, you describe American opponents today as having gone to school on the American experience in Vietnam, the Soviets in Afghanistan, and others. What have these enemies learned, and what are they applying?
Well, they've learned that the key thing is that you cannot beat the United States militarily. We're just too powerful. What you have to do is convince the American decision makers, and that's everything from the individual voters to Congress to the president, depending upon the political situation in the United States, you have to convince them that our political goals are either unobtainable or not worth the cost we're going to pay for them. And so that's obviously the goal. We have, in turn, to convince the nation that we're in, Iraq, that the Iraqi government can provide good governance. Counterinsurgency is about governance. And I think the elections last weekend were a huge first step, but only a first step. You'd ask, could we win this war or could the Iraqi army? In fact, only the Iraqi security forces can provide this security. We can support them, mentor them, train them, equip them, but they're the only ones who can really defeat an insurgency.
So you're saying in the end it boils down to political will, but does that mean that you're saying that the Pentagon should just keep banging away at Iraq with U.S. troops for as long as it takes, decades even, or I guess you're saying something else. It's got to be the Iraqis ultimately.
It has to be the Iraqis ultimately. What we have to do to preserve our will is present a coherent plan to the American people that lays out how we're going to do this. Because right now there's a fair amount of frustration in people I'm talking to that they don't know exactly what the plan is. And while you have to keep military specific secret, it's very, very important that the people understand what's going on so they can see how we're doing. The British in Malaya were losing for 3 years and losing badly. And yet now Malaya is pointed out as one of the most successful counterinsurgencies in history. And it's because they developed the Briggs plan, they publicized it, they stuck with it, and they worked it.
And what were the effective elements of that plan? What turned it around?
Probably the most important thing is they stopped chasing what they called terrorists around the jungles and started focusing on providing governance to the people. Because if you can convince the people that you're helping them, then they stop supporting the terrorists.
So the
if you just kill terrorists, there will always be more terrorists.
In that sense, the elections on Sunday have got to look like a good step forward. On the other hand, Iraqis can also look over and see Fallujah, which has essentially been emptied of its population. What kind of lesson is that? Is that also necessary?
Well, we had allowed a sanctuary to be created there, and then it did have to be dealt with. Now, the key thing is not how we dealt with it, but what we do with it now. How much money do we put back into it? How fast do we get it on its feet? And when it's on its feet, is it being run by Iraqi security forces? Is it insurgent-free? And that's going to be very difficult to do, but that is, in essence, the challenge.
Look at the insurgency for a moment in the largest terms, and I guess you would say it's really not confined to within Iraq's borders, and how you see it, and I don't know who to speak to of exactly here as the commander, but what's the strategy? Do you see a strategy being played out in the insurgency, and what's the evidence of the strategy?
Okay, you've got to understand that insurgencies are three things. They're political, they're protracted, and think decades, not years, and they're networked. So what we've got is a network, a coalition of the willing, and all they agree on, the only single goal they have is to get rid of the United States. After that, there is no goal, because we have seen Salafists, which are Sunni fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. We have seen Shia fundamentalists under Sadr. We have seen Sunni secularists, you know, former Baathists who just want Sunni control. We've seen criminal gangs. We've seen foreign jihadists. The only thing they have in common is they want to get rid of the United States. When that is done, they don't have a political agenda that they're unified on. They each have their own agenda. Salafis cannot possibly live with Shias. It's essentially against the religion of the Salafi to believe Shias are equal Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be the problem. Now, this is no surprise because that's been the pattern for insurgencies for a while. If you look at Afghanistan, once the Soviet Union announced it was leaving, the intramural started between the Afghan resistance. The Chechens the same way. When the Soviets started to get out, the Chechens had some spats between themselves. We're getting started on the makings of a civil war until the Russians came back in and reunified them. You look in Palestine where the Israelis announced they were withdrawing from Gaza. Immediately competition started in Gaza for which Palestinian resistance group would run Gaza.
So you're saying on the other side of a victory, if they were victorious, you'd see them splitting up. But while they're engaged in the insurgency, is this kind of ad hoc coalition a problem or not, or even a strength?
It's a strength because networks, the reason you design the Internet the way it is with all the nodes is it's almost impossible to knock it out. And what you do that tamps down one element of this insurgency inflames another. So it requires a fairly deft political hand, and we're starting to see that from the Iraqi leadership. It requires patience, and it requires understanding that you've got different problems in different parts of the country. Their victory, while they would declare victory if they drove us out, they're nowhere near victory then because each one then has to start fighting internally for what it is they want and what they see for the future of Iraq.
But at that point, if they were engaged in that, the U.S. would be gone and you would see them having gone in defeat, having lost Iraq, whatever exactly that means. What would you point to, so Americans can understand this, Colonel Thomas Hammes, as evidence of the Pentagon not being plugged in to the war that's underway here at this point?
Well, just last week, the Pentagon once again announced that we were going to man General Petraeus' staff. He's been over there about 10 months now, and it was supposed to be our highest priority to train the Iraqi security forces. That's his job.
That's his job, right.
But we haven't manned his staff, and yet we keep the Pentagon staff, the Joint Forces Command staff in Norfolk, Virginia, the various staffs, the United States, Europe, Pacific, at full strength or at the 90% manning strength. If you were really serious about Iraq and really believed that you had an insurgency and had to build Iraqi security forces, I think you would have provided the training personnel. You would have provided mentoring. You would have provided sufficient equipment. We still have Iraqis without helmets, flak vests, some weapons. There's been a lot of discussion in the media about the fact that U.S. forces do not have armored Humvees. And that's a very valid point. We don't have armored trucks. That has to be dealt with. That should be a question as to why that happened. But there's been almost no discussion of the fact that the Iraqis are riding around unarmored. When you see these ambushes on TV and you see the Iraqis, you'll notice they're in open-back pickup trucks.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a brave man to go out against an RPG in an open-back pickup truck.
So you've said that the U.S. talks about fighting an insurgency but doesn't actually fight that way.
Not yet. Now, there are indications now that both the Pentagon announcement and some of the actions that are being taken in the country in terms of pulling officers and staff NCOs or senior non-commissioned officers from the line units there, the combat units there, to have them train Iraqi security forces. That indicates a genuine seriousness on the part of the leadership inside Iraq. Again, Ambassador Negroponte and General Casey clearly get in and are working toward that. One of the interesting things is we still don't have enough translators. I don't know if we're not enough offering enough money, but if you're a rifle squad on the street in Iraq, you don't know what's going on without a translator. Even if we had to pay a translator $250,000 tax-free for a year, if he could keep one of those soldiers or Marines alive, then it actually is a money-making proposition because that, of course, is the death benefit, the insurance benefit if someone is killed in action.
Or it's proposed now. The Pentagon talks a lot about...
No, that is the actual... if you're killed in action and you have SGLI, the Servicemen's Group Life Insurance,
okay. Mm-hmm.
The payout is $250,000.
The Pentagon talks a lot about total information awareness warfare. Is that underway now? It's hard to imagine how it is if they don't even have translators to know what's being said. Does it work as an approach? It's been much vaunted and talked about.
Well, this is one of the most puzzling things. The Pentagon is still pushing network-centric warfare. I guess they've now renamed it net-centric and transformation.
And what do they mean when they say that? When the Pentagon says network-centric warfare, what do they mean?
Well, they mean this information dominance. They describe it as having information dominance, and because you know what's going on so clearly on the battlefield, you have a speed of decision which beats your enemy, and then you use precision weapons on him. I find it interesting they can cling to this viewpoint when we're in three significant conflicts now, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the misnamed global war on terror, and yet we don't know that well what's going on in any of them. So we're building a force that's based on dominance. In the three wars we're in, we don't have dominance. We're in an information deficit.
Thomas Hammes, stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. John Poole is joining us from Emerald Isle, North Carolina. He's a retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel, was a gunnery sergeant for many years, spent his last 7 years in the Corps as a gunnery sergeant. He's taught small unit tactics. That's the squad level down to 12 men. He's author of Tactics of the Crescent Moon, Militant Muslim Combat Tactics. John Poole, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
It's nice to be here.
John Poole, Thomas Hammes is talking at a high level about strategy here, about the concept of fourth-generation warfare. You've paid a lot of attention right down at the ground level to fighting and warfare in just the kind of circumstance American troops find themselves now. What do you see? How's it going? Are the right tactics being used on the ground in Iraq?
Well, my expertise is really at what happens at the squad below. And it would appear to me, only the good Lord knows for sure, of course, but it would appear to me that we'd have to dismount the vehicles.
In other words, get out of those Humvees and troop carriers that we're always seeing.
Yes. Now, there's an option rather than patrolling by vehicle, and that's to use the concept that was used by the Marine Corps very effectively in Vietnam. It was called a combined action platoon.
Meaning?
It's a combined unit with possibly a U.S. squad, an Iraqi National Guard squad, and an Iraqi police squad all in the same platoon.
But if the problem so far has been not enough armor on the Humvees, if you're out of the Humvee, you've got no armor except your flak jacket.
That's true. However, there are there is tactical technique in the world that would protect that platoon from many times their number if they were to be stationed inside the neighborhoods.
And if American platoons were out of the Humvees, out of the vehicles, and in the streets, maybe with the Iraqi troops, and there's been some question about how great that would be as backup, but what would they be doing in that circumstance, John Poole?
Well, during the day, they'd probably be providing local security and possibly working on public services projects. At night, they would have to disperse and basically ambush their zone of action to keep from being decimated by the militants.
Thomas Hammes.
They couldn't just sit in a headquarters at night. They'd have to do something.
Have to be out there. Thomas Hammes, is this part of what you mean, Colonel Hammes, in addressing a fourth-generation warfare scenario?
There's some things there. Obviously, the integration with Iraqi forces is important. The problem I have with most ambushing is we're fighting what is fundamentally an urban insurgent.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you tell the urban insurgent from the guy just coming home from work or coming home from a family party or a birthday? That would be difficult. The discussion on the Humvees is not so much about whether they're using them on patrol, although that is important because you can't patrol when you're driving by at 35, 40 miles an hour. But the real discussion in the United States has been the convoys. We're taking an enormous number of our casualties in the convoy work, and that's where the armored Hummer comes, not in patrolling, but in the convoy work and getting you to and from the location. More patrolling does allow you to interrupt this IED cycle because you see them putting them in, and that's what you know you can shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you have the improvised explosive device, you see someone handling that, then you're free to engage them. And that's where John's idea, and by the way, good evening, John.
Good evening, sir.
That's where his idea would be the most benefit.
Thomas Hammes, John Poole, I want to begin to get our callers in here. Andy's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Thank you. I agree with pretty much everything that's been said so far, and I just want to embellish and add to a couple of points real quickly.
Okay. What have you got?
First thing is that our first big mistake and a mistake that still probably dooms us in this venture is that the American people were basically not told the truth about why we were really going to Iraq, and there was not a consensus developed, a large enough consensus developed from the people.
Andy, do you say that as a civilian or a military man?
Well, I'm an ex-military man. I would say it as both.
Mm-hmm.
I served in Vietnam and in Germany in the 60s, and I was not told the truth about why we were going to Vietnam or going to Germany. And I noticed in listening to a lot of comments from current service people over in Iraq, at least to me the implication is that they're not really told why we're going over there. It seems like the same problem.
So maybe not the right buy-in. And the other part of your observation?
I would just like to really embellish the language thing, and I would to make the point from my own experience. I didn't have any knowledge of the language going to Vietnam. Of course, I was only there for 13 months and didn't have an opportunity. But I did spend 2.5 years in Germany, and I did learn. I already knew a little bit of German that I had learned in school before I went over there. And then
weren't fighting any guerrillas in Germany.
Well, let me just make my point.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot of German real quickly once I got over there, and I was probably one of only two other GIs that mixed well into the community and were not disliked as American soldiers. We were judged or liked or disliked as individuals, and I think there's a basic principle there that applies to any situation overseas for anybody.
And the language, a big part of the reason why. Andy, thanks for your call. Thomas Hammes, do you expect that American forces are going to be in Iraq long enough for this enormous military to develop the kind of expertise that you and John Poole are talking about? Let's say language. I mean, that's a project of not weeks, but months, years. Are we going to be there long enough to put that to use?
If we had on the 12th of September, when we understood we were in a generations-long war with an Islamic enemy, an understanding that Arabic is the language of the Quran, had said then, we have to have a lot of language speakers, and had offered any graduate student who could pass the Defense Language Aptitude Test and do well $50,000 a year to study Arabic with a payback system like ROTC, then this year we would be graduating our first graduates of that course, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I guess we would, and yet the years go by. John Poole, how about your observation, the learning curve that the U.S. is on in Iraq, is it quick enough to bring some kind of conclusion here in a time frame that Americans are going to accept?
Well, the best kind of learning happens on the job. And, for example, with this combined action platoon idea, the ambushing problem after dark is easily solved by just using a curfew. But that way the Iraqi National Guard and the police could be stood up at the same time that you're actually performing your mission, because they'd have the U.S. soldiers soldiers right there with them that could show them things and learn right on the job. And it's a much quicker way of learning than trying to put people into schools and
off
get them all prepared before you put them into combat.
Off at an academy somewhere, get out on foot. John Poole, author of Tactics of the Crescent Moon, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thomas Hammond, stand by. We're talking tonight about fourth-generation warfare and what it will take to defeat the insurgency in Iraq. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about fourth-generation warfare and the insurgency challenge after the election in Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Should the U.S. adapt and fight, or arm the Iraqis and get out, or train and stay? And if fourth-generation warfare takes decades, as our guest says tonight, who wins this one? And is the United States fighting the war that it's actually in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Thomas Hammes, Marine Corps Colonel, Senior Fellow at the National Defense University, and author of the new book, The Sling and the Stone, on War in the 21st Century. Jules is calling right now from Boston. Hi, Jules. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Colonel Hammes, there was some talk a little bit earlier about combined action platoons, and when the 1st Marine Division went back over last March, that's what they were talking about doing. And all we've really heard about since then are things that sound a little bit more like Stalingrad, going through Fallujah street by street, that kind of thing. I'm interested if you have any information on whatever happened to the CAP program for Iraq. Whether any elements of that are effective in any parts of Anbar province where the Marines went, or anything like that anywhere else. Another question I have is what the role of special forces is. This is supposed to be their kind of U.S. Army special forces. It's supposed to be their kind of war. I also wanted to ask more, but we can get to that if you like. About other historical successes of the U.S. and the British going back 100 years or over the past century in other places. The Marines had I believe it was either Nicaragua or Honduras in the 20s. The Brits had the Boer War.
That's a big sweep and a plateful, Jules. Let us pick it up. Thomas Hammes begins by describing this kind of warfare as the kind of war we lose. Let's hope that there's a brighter side to that. Thomas Hammes, to these questions, John Poole said we've got to have combined action platoons. Our caller Jules is saying, what about it? Is it actually happening? Are American soldiers out on patrol with Iraqis, or are the Iraqis all off being trained at an academy at a separate base somewhere?
In fact, both is happening. An army doesn't spring into existence either overnight or fully grown. So we've got the initial battalions out. We've got a Kurdish battalion that's very good. We've got some of the National Guard battalions that are pretty good. And they are progressing and are, in fact, patrolling. And as you saw in the elections, they were providing most of the security for the polling sites. So we are having some CAP effect in an urban environment like Fallujah. CAP doesn't work as well because it's not about pacification. That was flat-out urban combat. In other areas, I'm hearing that it's working, but again, it depends upon the level and quality of the troop that you're working with, which depends very heavily upon his leadership and political motivation.
What about the special forces role?
That's kind of interesting. The special forces had that role from the beginning, but post-Vietnam got out of it because essentially the U.S. Armed Forces said, okay, we're not going to do that insurgency stuff anymore. We're done with that. Because we had the Soviets staring at us across the plains, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And so we focused on the big war. And when I first started studying insurgency seriously in 1986, I had a year sabbatical at the Mershon Center. I went to Special Forces Center to find out who was writing the doctrine, and in fact, no one was.
On counterinsurgency, it was just atrophy,
they had
just gone.
That, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, just in the last year, the Army has reissued a manual on counterinsurgency, which is a pretty good one. Special Forces is torn between the direct action people, the Delta squadrons and things like that, the people who do hostage rescue, who do special operations direct action, and then the more traditional special forces role of training and mentoring. They're doing some of that. Obviously, there are not sufficient numbers to train an army of this size or security forces of this size. One of the other huge problems is police forces. We don't have a national police force, so it's very, very difficult for the United States to train police forces.
We don't have one in the United States, so it's hard to envision
right.
how it would work in Iraq.
Well, we know how to envision it. The problem is the people who do that are primarily our European allies, and some of them have helped us in Iraq. But if you want to have the large numbers of trainers and the national system, it helps to have a national system to draw from. We don't have that.
And what about Jules' larger historical question? You look to a Malaya, late 50s, early 60s, but you
yes.
write that you say our opponents know that fourth-generation warfare is the only kind of war America has ever lost and done so three times, in Vietnam, Lebanon, and Somalia. And then you cite this long list of the French in Vietnam, the Russians in Chechnya, Israel in Lebanon, Soviets in Afghanistan, French in Algeria, of powerful militaries losing. So is there more
yes,
example
almost,
for hope here?
Yeah. Almost every time that we lose, you can see it's because we never understood the war we were in. When we understand the war we're in, when they understood in Malaya, in Oman, in El Salvador, in Peru, we have pretty good success. Now, there are some earlier wars that go back, the Philippine insurrection, Nicaragua. They were fought under very, very different conditions. Remember I said warfare evolves to make use of the tools?
Mm.
If you had a massacre in the Philippines, it took 30 or 40 days for that word to get back to the United States. If we have a massacre in Iraq, 3 or 4 minutes before it's on CNN,
and
there's
of course, it's known quickly in the Pentagon as well. But you've said that you're concerned the Pentagon is doing too much micromanaging from Washington in spite of that communications, maybe because of it.
Yeah, I think because of it. That is also one of the problems that we have in this type of an operation. Because you can see and can talk, there's a real feeling that you need to help, you need to be in charge, that you know better. The problem is, of course, back in D.C., the people in these leadership jobs have crushing workloads. If you've ever watched these people, they have horrendous hours, a bazillion different problems, all of them tough, and all of them coming at them. They only have maybe an hour or 2 hours a day to even think about Iraq. So why you would sit back in Washington and think you knew more than the people on the ground who are living at 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, I'm not sure.
But is that going on?
It was when I was there. I don't know if that is still going on.
And that's just 9 months ago. Frank is calling from Park Ridge, New Jersey. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom. Good evening, Colonel. I'm ex-military. I was a lieutenant in the Army. I served in Desert Storm. And two questions for you, Colonel.
Yes.
First question is, you mentioned at the beginning a misnamed war. We're fighting a misnamed war, global war on terror. Could you explain a little bit more about that? Second question is, this is the second war in a row, Vietnam being the first, where our politicians lied to us, drag us into a war, and we're fighting a war where, you just mentioned a moment ago, the politicians the Pentagon is mismanaging it. And when you really think about it, our senior politicians who are running this war never served. They all had excuses, they all had reasons not to, and yet they've put us in a position now where our military is being hung out there.
Frank, our time is short. Let us pick those up. First, Thomas Hammes, I heard the same thing. You said that the war on terror is misnamed. What do you mean by that?
Terror is a tactic. That's like having a war on blitzkrieg or a war on fighter aircraft. You have a war on a movement. I think what we've got is not a global insurgency, but insurgencies around the globe that are linking together using the internet, using the improved communication systems and networks.
What's the difference between a global insurgency and a networked global
Well, one would assume that there's some kind of central control or someone who's got a single goal.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these are coalitions of the willing with very, very different goals other than to disrupt the U.S. I mean, that's one of the big things is to get the West out. But there's disagreement as to whether you should first fight the Western enemy, the far enemy, or you should fight the regimes in the Middle East, the near enemy. There are discussions about whether you're taking it down the path of Salafism, which is a very fundamentalist, a Wahhabi-type belief, or you're going with a Shia direction, or you're going with a secular one.
But
so all of those are different.
President Bush uses the phrase war on terror, perhaps in part because he must know, as you say, that part of what he needs to do is rally his countrymen. Maybe that's an effective phrase for doing it. Are you saying it also cuts the country off from understanding what it's engaged in?
I think that's part of the problem. I think when it was first used, it was used as a rallying term. We've now had time to clarify it. We also don't have a good record of war on things. We haven't done well in the war on poverty or in the war on drugs.
The caller is not the is the second to also ask about this issue of being misled and how that factors in with the American public, but also with the military itself. Does the military feel it was misled into this war? Is that a factor in its
outcome? This is becoming pretty political and polemic. If you'll recall, before this thing started, everybody, the Europeans said, yeah, he's got weapons of mass destruction. The intelligence services agreed. Now, whether, in fact, that was an honest evaluation, the fact is, apparently the director of the CIA said, we know for sure he's got them. The various agencies thought he had them. So for us now, in retrospect, now that we know you don't have them, to say we were lied to because they didn't say, it was a judgment call. You may fault the judgment. You may say he had bad information or we had bad information. But the fact is, it was a judgment call, and you got to make judgments, and sometimes they're not going to come out exactly right. That's another illustration of this whole thing of where this network center is crazy, because they think you'll know all and see all. Friction, fog, and uncertainty are an inherent part of war and will always remain that way.
Thomas Hammes, we've just got less than a minute left. You write that, make no mistake, that the Al-Qaeda is out to win in this war, from its angle at least. It's out to win. It thinks it can, and the record suggests it might. Who's winning right now?
Al-Qaeda has been rocked back pretty badly, I think, around the world. To say who's winning now, remember, we're 3 years in that we've been actively fighting. They've been at it now for 8 or 10 years. But this is probably a 30 or 35-year war with them, at least generational. So it's a little early to declare who's winning.
And in Iraq, the same kind of duration?
I don't think quite as long in Iraq, depending upon whether obviously the Shia and the Kurds like our presence and want to encourage that. And a lot of that's going to depend upon how the Iraqis themselves deal with that political dynamic.
Thomas Hammes, thanks so much for being with us tonight and for your thoughts on fourth-generation warfare. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Marine Colonel Thomas Hammes, his new book is The Sling and the Stone on War in the 21st Century. In a moment, American Idol, Chinese style. This is On Point. The Fox Network's reality TV smash American Idol has gotten off to a fast start again this season. The program's debut was the most watched non-sports program with 33 million viewers. But that figure is nothing compared to the estimated 100 million who will tune in to China's on-air talent competition, Arts from Our Land. The program features non-Chinese people showing off their talents in Chinese arts. Since 1995, it's run annually during Chinese New Year celebrations, which are going on now. One of this year's competitors was Eugene Cooper, an anthropology professor at the University of Southern California. He was flown to Beijing to tape his performance. He won second place. Tonight, for the first time on American radio, he performs the song that got him invited to China, a folk song about Mao Zedong.
Well, the whole experience was really quite surreal. All of us foreigners, all of us non-Chinese, there was a handful of Koreans as well as a handful of Japanese. There was a French guy who had written his own song. I came to China in the year 2000, and all of the personnel of the film crew were walking around singing it. It was really quite funny. I sang two songs. One was a Chinese folk song, Kang Ding Qing Ge, and then I sang the infamous Cultural Revolution song, Da Hai Hang Xing Kao Duo Shou, which means sailing the seas depends on the helmsman. Among the lyrics to the song are, you know, Chairman Mao is the sun that never sets, the revolutionary masses can never be separated from the Communist Party. And I do it in a, I don't know, Willie Nelson folk kind of rendition that is much softer than the martial rendition that was typical during the Cultural Revolution. I always get good response to it. There's something downright ironic about an American singing a song praising Chairman Mao, and Chinese audiences generally respond very favorably and get the joke. I have this, I don't know, I guess people characterize it as a cowboy hat, but it's really more of a fedora. And I wore this leather vest and my jeans, and I came out on stage, and they just liked the cowboy, I guess. They got a kick out of that and started applauding before I'd even opened my mouth. Then the first song, which I started to sing, they began to clap in what they assumed the rhythm to be, but which, in fact, was not the rhythm that I was intending to perform at. And I had to fight against the audiences imposing their rhythm on me. But during the second round, it was just altogether appropriate because the song's rhythm is more or less consistent throughout. So once they started clapping, I was able to kind of like ride that tide. And I guess that was probably the reason why I was awarded a second trophy for best audience reception. At the end of the contest, when it was clear that I had taken one of the second places overall, most of the people associated with the production of the show for Beijing TV all came around and said, you know, and we'd like you to come back next year, too. Wouldn't you like to do that? My response was, well, I'm not exactly sure. I think once is really quite enough. You know, I'm at this point waiting for the endorsement offers to come pouring in. I'm open to all possible offers. I think, for example, you know, Great Wall cigarettes. Mmm, now that's flavor. Don't you think that works? The song is Sailing the Seas Depends on the Helmsman, Da Hai Hang Xing Kao Duo Shou. It says, among other things, that just as a fish cannot be separated from water and a gourd cannot be separated from the vine, so the revolutionary masses cannot be separated from the Communist Party. Mao Zedong's thought is the sun that never sets. Da hai hang xing kao duo shou, wan wu sheng zhang kao tai yang. Yu lu zi wen he miao zhuang, dan ge ming kao di shi mao zi tong zi xiang. Yu er li bu kai shui ya. How about them apples?
Eugene Cooper is professor of anthropology at the University of Southern California and a big winner in this year's Arts from Our Land talent show in Beijing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.